welcome to another edition of Old School Guns, the podcast that tells you like it is. And first of all, we'd like to say this is episode number 63, so we're kind of cruising down the road, 63 episodes, so that's quite a bit. That's roughly about 60 to 65 hours of time, so that's pretty cool. One of the things that we'd like to do is thank everyone who bothers to listen to this and tunes in. We have people even from foreign countries now who basically tune in. I assume it's not my magnetic personality. I hope it's the content. And I hope they understand English, because my ability to translate into any other language is severely limited. I suppose we could get, someday we'll maybe entice our friend of the podcast, who is a native Spanish speaker, to maybe he'll translate one and get it into the South American market. But actually, I would not ask to do that. So we have a lot of interesting stuff. Of course, kind of been handling a few things. So it's been about 2 weeks since we've done a podcast, and in that 2 weeks, a lot of things have happened. I thought that Joe Biden was just dead in the water. And, you know, in any other political year, he would have been. But the fact that his major rival is Bernie Sanders, who, you know, is, face it, the guy's a communist. They call him a socialist all they want. The guy's a communist. Not that Biden is much different, because he's not, and I'll talk about that a little later. But the Democratic Party, the establishment, knows that they can control Biden. They know that he's kind of their guy, and they're afraid that, you know, if Sanders gets the nomination, he will not only wreck the establishment, but also most Americans won't like that, and there'll be a lot of down-ballot damage, they call it, meaning people won't vote for Democrats anywhere on their ballot, because the head of their ballot is a frickin' communist, and people know it. So they've all kind of coalesced around Biden, so we don't have the third-grade teacher anymore, Elizabeth Warren. We don't have the dorky librarian, Klobuchar. We don't have Booty Cakes, you know, the little guy from Youngstown, Ohio, who has all the answers and is the first and is this courageously openly gay man, you know. We don't have any of that. All the identity politic junk has just kind of been brushed to the side, and so you now have 79-year-old Bernie Sanders. Or you have 78-year-old Joe Biden, so take your pick, you know. But they won't give it to Sanders, and they're going to cheat him out of it, and there's going to be a Never Biden movement, kind of like there was with, you know, Never Trump. You know, all the establishment, not all, but some establishment Republicans basically said they would never vote for him, and you know, those guys kind of got washed away, but the Never Biden campaign is much more serious, because it shows the Democratic civil war in their party that we were talking about earlier. But, you know, even more disconcerting than that, and nobody really cares about that. I don't really care about Democratic Party politics, because frankly, if you vote Democrat, you are really putting yourself on the wrong side of the fence, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, it just, there's no good Democrats anymore. They've chased those people away from their party. But Biden is just plain ass crazy. Biden is crazy. And now, I don't know if it's senility or dementia. I assume that it's part of that. I assume it's part Alzheimer's. But Biden goes to an auto factory and starts, and a guy basically comes up and says, "Hey, you're going to take our guns away." Rather than using that as an opportunity to say, "No, that's not really what I said. Here's kind of what I said." And here, you know, rather than using that as an opportunity to explain himself, because the guy was pretty articulate. He was talking to it. It wasn't like the guy was all red-faced and shouting and doing anything. The guy was calm. Biden is the one who lost it, even to the point where he says he's going to take the guy outside. Now, you know, Biden's 78 years old, and the deal is he cannot survive a beatdown, and so he shouldn't be challenging people to fights. Now, I know that it would never get that way, because simply he is, you know, guarded by, I assume, if it's not Secret Service, it will be. But, you know, he's got all this security around him and everything else. But, you know, when he's up getting into somebody's face like he was, hey, there are guys who can literally, throw a punch in the blink of an eye. And I mean, so Biden shouldn't be yelling at people. He shouldn't be insulting them. He shouldn't be challenging them to fights right to their face, because sometimes somebody will snap and they'll let Joe have it. And I can't imagine who couldn't take, especially somebody in their youth and prime, say in their 20s or 30s or even their 40s, couldn't take Joe into the octagon. And literally, he could not survive it. They wouldn't call an ambulance. They would have to call a hearse, because Joe can't survive a fist fight. And he's going to get broken in two if he doesn't shut his mouth and do it. But people see what he is. He's a crazy old man. He's crazy. He can't even make sentences sometimes. You've seen the one gaffe after another after another after another. It's just unfreaking believable. And the Democratic Party, so now it becomes, this is kind of the deal of, we haven't had this since 1944, where it's like everybody kind of knew Roosevelt, even though he was running for re-election, he probably wasn't going to make it the whole term. There was a lot of concern about that. So that's where, ergo, they were looking very carefully at who was going to be his running mate, because they knew that's who you were really voting for on some level. You were really voting for the guy who's on the bottom of the ticket, the vice president. So it's going to be very, very interesting. I don't think the American people are going to buy that in sufficient numbers to give Biden any kind of a victory. I think this is a desperation move on the Democratic Party. And even if and when Biden loses, because he will, but when Biden loses, they're hoping for really two things, to salvage two things out of the election: that the Democratic Party establishment is intact, which Bernie Sanders would not do, he would destroy it. And they're hoping that maybe they could maintain possession of the House of Representatives and whatever state seats that they have, across the country, that there won't be the down ballot damage that a Sanders candidacy is feared to bring to them. So, that those are the things that the Democratic Party says, hey, we lose the election, so what? We just start working on 2024, and but we want to preserve our party structure, and all the power players want to stay in their positions and everything else. So that's the deal. But we should be concerned about Biden. Biden is crazy. Even animals don't like Biden. We got a couple animals running around the house. Every time they see Biden on TV, they run away. So even animals don't like Biden. So Biden is the worst. He's a senilic influence peddler, and that's what he is. And there's no other way to say that. Only a crazy man, only a senile, would challenge people 20, 30, or 40 years his junior to a fight, to a fist fight. I'll take you outside. We'll take it outside now, pal. Okay, Joe. This isn't your fictional corn pop you're talking to. This is actually a real person. And they'll never let him take somebody outside and fight. Understand that. But there could be some explosion where some guy's gonna paste him right, give him one right in the jaw, because you just can't treat people like that if you're a politician. The best thing he could have done is try to explain himself. Then he just kind of moves on, and it's not that important. So anyway, that's the deal with Crazy Joe. And actually, I think we should start calling him Pee Wee Biden. I think that's a better name for him, because anybody who took him into the octagon, it would look like Mike Tyson on Pee Wee Herman. So Pee Wee Biden is what we actually have. All right, let's talk about what I call chrono preppers. And these are the people you can thank for the fact that, there's no more spam, there's no more toilet paper, there's no more canned chicken and noodle soup. People are buying stuff. There's actually a kind of a word for this, okay? It's called economic therapy, where I'm scared about the future, or I'm uncertain about the future, and this coronavirus, I don't know what they call this thing. coronavirus is, I guess, correct. People are uncertain. Some people are very afraid. So they have money in their bank accounts, and they go down to the store, and they spend money on stuff they think they're going to need if they get quarantined or if they get locked up or all of a sudden, you know, they can't get things anymore. So they buy toilet paper, Spam, and all this other stuff. A lot of it I guess they'll use the toilet paper. So there'll be a spike in the toilet paper market. You watch. 2 months from now, there'll be toilet paper sales everywhere because the factories will ramp up, but everybody will have had all this ungodly amounts of toilet paper they bought now, and they'll be using it for the next couple months. So we will have a flooded market of toilet paper. But, you know, this is the same kind of thinking that screwed over everybody during the ammo shortage, you know, after, what was it, Sandy Hook. And it happens periodically. You know, I know guys who'd go in and they'd say, oh man, I got a box of 38s at Cabela's. They only had four boxes. And there were three other guys and they each snagged one and I got the last one. And I'm like, oh great, do you have a 38? And the answer is either one of two things. Yes. And I go, well, how often do you shoot it? Well, I never really shoot it, but I saw these 38s, so I bought it. A, that contributes to the shortage. Because if there hadn't been a shortage, they never would have bought it because it's for a gun they don't shoot. Or B, well, I don't have a 38, but I know that's really, 38 specials are really common caliber, so I know I could trade it to somebody for something else. Okay? That's what got us $35 bricks of 22s. That's what got us all this stuff. It's terrible. Absolutely terrible. Hoarding never makes you more secure. It just makes the market more unstable. You know, people who are hoarding 22s. And then you get the people who think they're going to make the quick economic score. You know, like, man, I got these, you know, bricks of 22, 500 rounds used to be 10 bucks. So guys buy those, and then something happens, and then 4 months later, guess what? You can get 35, 45, or even 50 bucks at a gun show for a brick of 22. So these guys bring their 22, and they hope to sell it to people who are practicing, what did I say earlier? Economic therapy. Economic therapy. You don't need these 500 rounds of 22, and you're not going to use them. You're going to take them home and squirrel them away and say, I got it. And in case the world collapses, I will have 22s, at least 500 of them. And the economic therapy is there. You know, it's the same thing with actual doomsday preppers. You know, a couple of these guys who have YouTube channels are basically, you know, they're all smug saying, hey, I told you so. Because they've been practicing economic therapy for years, in some cases decades. And it's like, I've told you the stories. There are guys who have, you know, feminine napkins for their families, you know, stuffed into every closet. There are guys who, you know, every time they drink a 2-liter bottle of soda, they fill it with water and put it away somewhere. You know, there's all of this nonsense. All of this economic therapy is going on. And the fact of the matter is, if you actually do what FEMA says to do is the right thing. You know, you should inventory the food you have in your house and, you know, and then buy a little bit extra to keep you going for, say, 2 weeks. You know, that's actually a good policy. That's actually smart. But I would say that if most people went through their refrigerators, freezers, and their pantries, you could make it for 2 weeks. Now, it might not be, you know, you're not eating it at the Ritz, you know, this isn't like a restaurant meal all the time, and there will be no fast food, no McDonald's breaks or anything, but you can get by, because number one, all of us can get by on a lot less food than what we actually eat, and number two, you know, there's a lot more in our house than we think, you know, four or five tins of tuna fish, well, you know, you can make that go someplace. All the stuff in your fridge and your freezer and everything, they can all go someplace. So, you know, you will have calories that you can ingest. It's always wise, I think, you know, if you can get them and if they're fairly current, you know, having some some MREs, because you can live on an MRE a day. They do it all the time, especially if you're not doing strenuous activity. But you know, you should have a little bit of food, just so that you know, just so that you have the presence of mind and the security of knowing that, hey, this is here, and you know, if we have to, we can make it. The bigger problem, rather than food, will be water. As long as the municipal water is working, or your well is working, and all of that, you're going to be okay. If you have running water and the food in your house, you got the good basis for being okay. And you don't have to. And since it's a virus and not a gang of 1% ninja mutant bikers, you don't really have to. Since you can't shoot a virus, you really don't have to worry about putting any additional weapons or ammunition away. I think that's just. I went into Walmart to get something, and of course the grocery area was just buzzing. You know, people were in there, you know, buying 30 cans of deviled ham and all the rest of it. And but man, you went to any other part of the store, it was empty. You know, I mean, usually if you go back and in the days when I used to buy some ammunition there, I really don't anymore. You know, you would have to look around to find the person with the keys to the little you know, locked display case that had the ammo in it, and who had the right permission on the register to ring you up in the sporting goods, because they won't let you take it up front. They ring it up for you right there. And you know, but that person was just sitting there with nothing to do. Usually you have to go find them because they're off, you know, with a clipboard doing something, but this time they had nothing to do. So you know, you don't need weapons and ammunition for the coronavirus. All you really need is just inventory your food, take care of it, and, you know, supplement it reasonably. But, yeah, a truckload of toilet paper, even as trading material, probably isn't the way to go. Okay, here is another issue that came up. As you know, they used to have protocols for naming Navy ships. And, you know, they were really cool. I always thought it was cool to have a ship called, you know, the Exeter or the Lexington or the Yorktown, you know, after some of these great deal. Well, they kind of gotten away from all that. And I guess they kind of named submarines after cities. I don't even know what they named cruisers after anymore. They named battleships after states, but since we don't have battleships anymore, the big nuclear submarines, the missile submarines are states. The smaller the attack submarines are cities. I don't know what they name cruisers after anymore. And they usually kind of name destroyers after kind of naval heroes. And so anyway, to go along with that, they're now naming. They used to name aircraft carriers after whatever they wanted to name them after. It usually was big battles, but now it's people. And so there was Doris Miller, who was actually known as Dory Miller for years, a black mess steward who jumped on an anti-aircraft gun at Pearl Harbor, shot at the Japanese, and was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross. He later, 6 months later, was on the aircraft carrier, small aircraft carrier called the Liscombe Bay, which was sunk in action, and he and most of the other crew members on that were lost. So during the war, I think they named a destroyer escort after him, you know, a small frigate type ship, you know, and they were naming things out of everything. I've actually got another story about somebody I knew whose grandfather had a ship named for him. And these guys all did something courageous. I mean, face it, they all did something courageous. And so there are actually people complaining that, well, Doris Miller shouldn't, and his family says his name was actually Doris. The Navy changed it to Dory so it didn't sound like a lady's name. Okay, that's fine, whatever that is. Doris Miller, good to go. And here's the reason why we should name an aircraft carrier after him. Not because it's the first African-American to have an aircraft carrier named after them. Nobody really cares about that. I don't really care about that. I don't care what the person's race was. The fact of the matter is, the guy did more than his fair share at Pearl Harbor, and he lost his life on an aircraft carrier. Therefore, I think that's a pretty good candidate to have as a guy to name an aircraft carrier after. Now, you know, there is a little bit of controversy about how, you know, it wasn't like the movie where he was shooting down Japanese planes left and right. one of the accounts I read basically said he was almost a big danger to the Japanese as he was to his own side, because he was firing kind of wildly and probably hitting other ships and things. But, you know, who cares? The deal is they should name an aircraft carrier after a sailor who distinguished himself at Pearl Harbor and then lost his life on an aircraft carrier. I just can't think of anybody else who should have an aircraft carrier named after him. You know, the presidents are fine. Yeah, Gerald Ford served on an aircraft carrier, and he had a very, very, you know, distinguished war record. You know, so I think that, you know, yeah, definitely a lot of these guys. Ronald Reagan, definitely, you know, what he did for the U.S. military was miraculous. So, yeah, you know, it's former presidents, you know, and because Jimmy Carter had served on a submarine, I think they named a submarine after him. So, you know, it goes on and on, but I don't think that should be a controversy. And that's been completely submerged by coronavirus and all the rest of it. But my deal is that, you know, it has become political how the Navy names ships, why they would name anything after Gabby Giffords. It's crazy. Gabby Giffords did not deserve to have a ship named after her. She was never an advocate of the Navy. She was never anything. You know, she survived an assassination attempt. How does that relate to naval service? I don't know. But anyway, that's what's going on there. So, yeah, definitely we should have a USS Doris Miller. And, yes, Doris was a man's name as well as a woman's name. So there we go. Okay, next issue, and we got a couple of a lot of gun-related stuff here. First of all, you know, let's talk about a couple of myths that just keep popping up that are really trash. And these are both controversial myths. The first one is gun break-in. You know, I used to actually kind of believe in that, you know, well, especially with a semi-automatic, that, you know, you have to fire it 200 to 400 times to kind of break it in, kind of, you know, get the parts used to working together and all that. You know, that's absolutely bunk. It's absolutely bunk. And here's why you know it's bunk. No military I know of, including the U.S. military, basically has a break-in period for a firearm. You know, during World War II and any time thereafter. And I've actually done that. I've received M16A2, new in wrap. And there was no break-in regimen for that. You take it out, you lubricate it. Now it does have some user things where you lubricate it, and then you take it out, and it's expected to work 100%. It just does. So, and same thing in World War II. We didn't break in 1911s because we needed to get the surfaces used to sliding against each other, or anything like that. We didn't do it with M1 rifles, M1 carbines, we didn't do it with any small arm. There's no break-in period. So when you're reading these gun magazines and gun online reviews and all that, we got this break-in. No, if a gun is not functioning, it is not functioning. And really, there's no break-in regimen that will cure a malfunction. Now, I will say that, you know, magazines, sometimes when they're new, you know, if you load them and unload them once or twice, just by hand, not even through the firearm, but just load them, unload them. You know, you've done your due diligence there. I mean, there's no, and make sure there's no, like, somehow there's crud or something in there from the manufacturing process. But basically, everything should work out of the box. So gun break-in is a myth. Gun break-in is a myth, and it's been used by a lot of gun writers and gun reviewers and content creators and all the rest of this. You know, whatever kind of title they want. These people who are doing gun reviews, that's used as a way to kind of cover that, hey, the gun I have isn't working 100%. They want to tell you, especially a lot of these guys who, you know, have got a relationship with the manufacturers, they want to tell you, hey, this gun's 100% reliable, good to go, spend your money on it. I mean, very seldom do you see a gun review that does not say that. Very seldom. And the answer is because a lot of these guys are, and they'll say they don't, and they'll swear on a stack of Bibles that they don't get any kind of freebie or any kind of consideration from these companies. Whatever all that is, I don't care. you got to give an honest deal. The gun works or it doesn't, you know. And if it doesn't work, okay, is it the fault of the ammunition? Is it the fault of the magazine? And, you know, you can kind of go down from there because not every malfunction is the gun's fault. So, consequently, guns should work 100% out of the box. If you have you go buy a brand new 1911 or a brand new 9mm anything, it should work 100% out of the box. First round through, you know, however many you're going to shoot through it. Same thing with rifles. Same thing. There is no break-in period. And that brings us to the next one of barrel break-in. There's all this kind of voodoo and hocus-pocus about breaking in a barrel, especially, quote, a match barrel, quote, unquote, is the same thing. It's a lot of garbage. And guys really get worked up because it becomes part of this myth. It becomes part of conventional wisdom. And the fact of the matter, it's just not true. If you've bought a barrel as under the guise of a match barrel, and I'll talk about what match means later. If you've bought a barrel and the manufacturing on it is so sloppy that you need to work burrs off it and everything else, you have not bought a match barrel. You have bought something that somebody has just cranked off with the sloppiest of standards. So, you know, I've seen it. I've seen it 100 times. I've seen it done. I've seen it where guys think that they're breaking in a barrel. And they're doing nothing. Basic metallurgy will tell you that, there's no way that a copper jacket bullet is going to smooth out a steel bore. Even if you put this little moly coating or you run a patch with lapping compound or anything, it's really not going to work. It's not going to do anything. And, that's not what is going to contribute to accuracy. What's going to contribute to accuracy are the chamber dimensions, the bore dimensions, the crown, those things contribute to accuracy. And none of those you can affect by these kind of ritualistic break-in methods. And then we also get to something I alluded to just a few minutes ago, which is, well, what is really a match barrel? A lot of times we use the word match to infer, well, it has a higher standard of manufacture, or it's been tested, or there's some secret sauce, some magical component which makes it more accurate than a standard barrel. Usually that is, it's a heavy barrel or a heavier contour barrel than the standard barrel you would normally find in that type of firearm. So if you've got a big, thick contour on your bolt action rifle as opposed to a very light contour that you would have for a hunting rifle, it's presumed to be more accurate, especially over a longer period of shots. So that's what match infers. Now, there was, some U.S. military stuff with M1s and all these things where they did match, M14s especially, match conditioning and all the rest of it. But that has drifted into civilian life. And actually with 1911s also, there were match barrels, there were this, that, the other thing. So, it definitely, buyer beware, that match is a label that anybody can stick on anything. And you wind up paying a premium for something that may or may not actually have more inherent accuracy. So, to get back to the deal though, barrel break-in is a myth. It's an absolute myth. And there are a lot of people besides myself who say this, and very credible people. Now, you will find a lot of voodoo, and you will find people who swear, well, the first group, I fired a 3-shot group, and it was 1.5 inches. And then, after they went through their conditioning process of cleaning it every other round and lapping compound and all the rest of this, well, I shrank it down to under an inch. Well, that can also be attributed to A, ammunition, and B, it can be attributed to being more familiar with the rifle and actually improving your marksmanship. There's very little that practice won't fix. Outside of a strict mechanical issue, practice which I'm sadly lacking on now due to weather and a few other factors, there's very few things that practice will not fix. And practice will fix accuracy. A lot of people don't want to admit it. They'll spend more money on theoretical fixes, again, to go back to the prepping, economic therapy, they will do that as opposed to buying more ammunition, firing, or getting some coaching and firing. So barrel break-in, gun break-in are both myths, and you know, you're wiser if you haven't been brought in by those. Okay, the next thing is funny. Okay, talk about, and I think everybody's heard this, you know, the gun bullshit story. I have to give a little background. Basically, last weekend, we took a little trip. And on the trip, I purchased a birthday present for my spouse, a Marlin Saddle Ring Carbine. It's an old gun, in 3840. It's in very nice shape, you know, mechanically. The finish, like on all those, is you know, somewhat worn. But the mechanics are excellent. The bore is excellent. The mechanics are excellent. And so I was in there, and I was kind of I was giving it the inspection. And of course, it was not in a gun shop. It was in an antique store, which I'm always suspect. That's why I give everything a real stringent inspection, because you don't know, because these aren't really gun people you're buying it from. This is somebody who got it out of an estate or whatever. And is licensed to do kind of a state firearm sort of thing. So they, if they have an FFL, it's simply to do that. It's not like they're immersed in the gun trade. So I'm looking at this Marlin, and it's a very, very nice gun. And I'm wondering about the purchase price was something. It was close to what I thought I would like to pay for it, but it was a little bit high. So I was going over in my mind, and I knew I would negotiate with him. But the guy puts on the bullshit story hard sell. And here's the hard sell. He goes, well, you know, at San Juan Hill, Teddy Roosevelt was supposed to get Winchesters for his men, but he got these instead because Winchester couldn't supply them. Okay, complete horseshit. Teddy Roosevelt, or Theodore Roosevelt, as you want to call him, did have a Model 1895 Winchester rifle of personally that he had, and it was in what we now call 3040 Krag, which at the time was 30 caliber U.S. Army. Okay, so it took the same ammunition as the regular Army Krag rifles and carbines, but it was a different gun. It was a Winchester. So he had that. His men were supposed to get, because they were a volunteer regiment, were supposed to be equipped with the single-shot 1884 trapdoor cavalry carbines, what we call the trapdoor. You know, a single-shot black powder 4570. But he used his influence to get them issued the newer Krag repeating carbines, bolt-action carbines, not single-shots. And he used his influence to do that. So, yes, he did use his influence to change how his men were armed for the Spanish-American War, but it had nothing to do with Winchester vis-a-vis Marlin, because Marlin just was not used. Now, this is a very nice gun, and I don't know why this guy put this story on it. Then the story gets better. He goes, well, you know, Annie Oakley had one of these. And I'm like, I'm kind of playing dumb, because this is really, you can correct the guy, but you're not going to, I really didn't want to make him mad, because I was gonna basically negotiate price a little bit later. So I could have easily shot holes in the first story, but I just sort of, oh, that's very interesting, you know. Just, and I'm looking at the gun, because I always buy the gun and never the story anyway. So then it's like, well, Annie Oakley had one of these, not this particular gun, but she had a Marlin, which is true. Unfortunately, it was a .22 rifle and not a 3840 saddle ring carbine. So consequently, it's, you know, it's a gun of the same, made by the same firm, and roughly the same kind of action, but completely different caliber and different configuration. So it goes on and on, and then he shows me a picture he has of Annie Oakley, and lo and behold, you know, she's got a Marlin, but it's of course a lot longer, And it even said Marlin 22 long rifle in the caption, you know. So, you know, I kind of went with that, and yeah, that's great. And you know, we went on and on. And basically I negotiated, made an offer, a couple offer, counter offer type deals, came to a price, bought it, very happy with the gun. But as we were driving away, my wife goes, well, doesn't he know that, couldn't he figure out that you were really into guns and you really, you know, that you might not believe some of these things? And I go, you know what? Some people don't learn. The hard sell is the worst way to go. If he had been somewhat just kind of indifferent, going, yeah, I've got this gun, it's really nice. And if he'd been that way, it probably would have been a lot better and a little more professional. But to tell people stories without even, you know, a shred of, I mean, those are things you could easily, in the days of Google, you can easily, you know, correct whatever impressions you have or check the information you're going to tell people. You know, back in the 60s where, hey, the only gun information were magazines that were published once a month. And if you didn't go down and buy like three magazines, you know, that was three mag, you know, people bought Guns and Ammo, Shooting Times, and, you know, then there were probably three or four others that you could pick up. But, you know, if you didn't pick up the information that way, you just didn't know. And there was all kinds of myth in those earlier gun magazines in the 50s and 60s. But this, in this day and age, in 2020, that's really unforgivable. But, yeah, that was it. So, the crowning thing on this is, I said, when was this gun made? And he goes, well, it was made in 1940. And, of course, I knew that by 1940, nobody was making 38-40 long guns. 38-40 basically probably went out about 1920, and then has recently been reborn in Winchester replicas and maybe even Marlin. I'm sure that you could rechamber a Marlin for it if you wanted to. So, as it turns out, I was kind of correct. The gun was made about 1910, because I knew it probably was pre-1920. You know, there's a way you can tell the age of a gun by kind of the caliber. You kind of look at the roll marks. If you've seen enough guns, you can tell an older gun from a newer gun right away. It's the wood, the metal, the patina, the script used in the roll marks, the caliber, all those things. You can add that up and you can actually make a pretty good, I was surprised, I made a pretty good estimate. I said pre-1920 and it turned out 1910. As it turns out, Marlin's serial numbers kind of end at 1906 and then pick up again in the late 40s. I think they must have had a fire or they lost the records or something. So, you know, it's kind of the last number. You kind of interpolate what your number is off the last number, kind of figuring out how many they made a year. And you can come up pretty close to which year it was made for that whole break where it was where the records are gone. Okay, next thing. A really great movie. In this era of coronavirus panic, I'm not really going to movie theaters. So I saw the movie 1917 on, I think it was Amazon Prime. Excellent movie. It doesn't really tell a World War I big story. It really does not. It's essentially, and you can read the reviews of it, that I'll just kind of comment on what I thought was the real high points of the movie for me, which was the authenticity in gear. Scenes, you know, the trenches looked real, No Man's Land looked real, all that stuff really looked real, and was really very well done, very well researched. I'm sure that there are people who, and I've only seen it once, so I'm sure there are people who can, there are some details that are wrong, because there always are, there just always are, or details that they think are wrong, but you know, I thought it was very, very well done. I thought the acting was excellent. The story, a little implausible, but, you know, it's a movie. It's, you know, it's a movie. So there you go. It did not... bog itself down with a love story. There wasn't some, you know, there are a lot of good movies that they try to incorporate that. The Light Horseman is one where they got to put this love story. They got to kind of interject that. I thought that was one of the improvements of the movie Midway, the latest one over the 1974 version, which, you know, had to have a love story kind of in it. They've kind of gotten away from that formula when they're trying to tell something definitely that's a little more historically oriented and trying to capture the mood of the moment or the uncertainty of the moment. Movie Dunkirk was the same way. So they've done a really excellent job with that. And the movie's very excellent. It moves. It's got action. It's really quite good. Really quite good. So I thought that definitely it was worth the Oscars it got, and it probably should have gotten more. But it was really an excellent movie, and I'm really glad to have seen it. I wish I would have seen it on the big screen, but with the virus fears, that's just not in the cards right now. So I would say everybody, hey, enjoy it at home, because we may be spending a lot more time at home than we thought. All right, getting from that to what is really my favorite part of this, which is always the questions and answers. And feel free to always send your questions and answers into me, KBMAKEL at AOL.com. God, I had a moment there. I had a Biden moment, a Pee Wee Biden moment. KBMAKEL at AOL.com. And you can always go ahead and leave them on Podbean. They have a place for comments, and you can toss a question up there, and I will certainly get to it. This question came to me last week. I've been doing some 45 ACP hand loading. If the virus thing subsides, I hope to go out to the Zoot Shooting National match. They're talking about reviving that. It was gone for a year, but they're talking about reviving that out in Byers, Colorado. So it'd be awesome to go out there and do that again. God, it's been, the last time I was there was 2012. Was it 2012? I had to do a job change in 2013, and life has gotten in the way since then. And then I was all set to go last year. I was all mentally prepared to go, and they decided not to have it. So I'm like, oh, shoot, man, this is a bummer. So anyway, that I hope to go out there. So I've been loading some 45 ACP. And one of the questions when I mentioned this around where I work is, well, you know, when you load that, how do you get all these rounds, your Dillon machine spits out all these rounds, what do you do with them after that? You know, they spit out into the blue tray, because I was explaining how this whole thing worked. Well, what do you do with them after this blue tray fills up? Well, it's pretty simple. What I actually do is, I usually load them in 100-round increments. Even if I'm going to load 300 rounds in a day, I do it in 100-round increments. And what I do is I get a little Ziploc baggie, the sandwich-sized baggie, and I put that 100 rounds in there. I seal it up, and then I put it in a GI ammo can. And I find that's the best for long-term storage. Plus, it puts them in convenient packs, because a lot of times I don't want to take the whole 500. And I get about 45 ACP, I can get 500 rounds in a can. Sometimes I don't want to haul that whole can, especially if I'm just test firing or I'm just going to shoot a 1911 or a 45 revolver at the end of a range session. I just go ahead and take 100 rounds, just lift out one of those baggies, put it in a shooting bag, and hey, it's done. It also gives me a way that I can kind of inventory the ammunition. So I know, hey, you know, I've taken two packets out, there are three packets left, so hey, there's 300 rounds in this can. If you just dump them in there and have 500 loose rounds in a can, well, you take out a couple of handfuls, you don't know how many there are. So it precludes me from having to do a lot of counting, and that's how I do it. Plus, I think, you know, inside the sealed bag, you know, the little Ziploc bag, inside of a sealed ammo can that's got a good rubber seal on it, you know, GI metal ammo can, you know, I think you're doing pretty well. You know, that's that's pretty weatherproof. That's a pretty good way to store things. And so there you go. That's how I normally do it. Way back in the day, I tried to get, and Midway actually sold a lot of them. And, you know, they had the little plastic cartridge boxes, you know, that, hey, they look cool, you know, and I still have a few of them floating around. But frankly, those things, they bounce around. They, you know, once you use all the ammo out of them, they're kind of bouncing around in that morass of stuff you take to the range. And so it's something else to kind of keep track of. So I don't really care for them. I do like another advantage of the plastic baggies are is that, you know, you have a place to put your expended rounds, you know, and that's really nice because you have these expended rounds. You have a nice place for them, and then you can go dump them into your box or your tumbler or whatever at the end of the shooting session. So, you know, that's convenient also. So that's basically how I do that. I've kind of gotten away from those little boxes. I've also had, you know, the usual problems with those boxes are, after a few years, they don't click shut anymore, or the ones that have the lid that lifts off, you know, those things get tipped over, and then all of a sudden you got ammo all over the place. You really don't have that with a bag. You take out what you need, you reseal the bag, and it's, again, this entity that's not really going to scatter rounds everywhere. It really can't tip over. It really can't, you know, all the bad things just can't really happen. So that's how I handle that. I'm sure there's a lot of other ways to do it too. One of the things I don't like doing though is when I buy ammunition in bulk is when it comes that way. It just comes with the can, you open it up, because then I usually have to break it down and put it into bags. Sometimes I don't. I just, you know, live with it. But I really like it when it's kind of subdivided and broken into manageable amounts. Okay, what's the worst ammo you've ever used? Well, I can tell you right now, it's surplus. And it was years and years and years ago. And it was just some sort of Egyptian or Middle Eastern surplus 9mm that was horribly corrosive. And just dirty ammo to shoot, and that's the worst. So I'd say surplus. I'll be honest with you, I used to be a big surplus ammo guy, but I've told you my horror stories. I say that, you know, another one is the horror story I had. I had this two boxes of this beautiful 8mm Mauser ammo that it was too good to use. I was saving it for my Hakim. I said, oh man, you know, I'll just use this in the Hakim, you know, because it's really good stuff. And that's a little kind of an ammo-sensitive gun. So anyway, I saved it. And then when I finally took it out, every other round was a dud. You know, I mean, it was terrible ammunition. Yet, it was beautiful, shiny, looked like it had been stored well. No moisture, nothing, none of the usual problems you see with some surplus, you know, no blemishes, no green corrosion or anything. It looked like it was brand new ammo. It looked like brand new. If you went and bought a box of, you know, PPU ammo, 8mm Mauser, full metal jacket, it looked just like this. It would look just like this. But this stuff goes off every other one. And I mean, this is not, well, there was a light primer strike or something else. I went and tried to fire this stuff in a Mauser bolt action. It had the same result. So, you know, that's some of the worst ammo you can ever get is going to be surplus. The only surplus I really like and trust is USGI, because we have such a high standard of manufacture. The other stuff, which is the stuff that's almost as good, is anything from the UK, you know, whether it be Radway Green or the stuff from, even the stuff from Malaysia, which is basically made under British supervision and assistance. You know, that stuff's really good. The other stuff that's good, you know, you can get some, occasionally you can get the MEM stuff from Germany and a few things like that. Warsaw Pact stuff is usually very reliable, but, and the AK ammo and the 7.62x54 ammo I have no issues with, but the Tokarev 7.62x25, the stuff I've had has been junk. It's just been terrible ammo. So I don't really care for that. So anyway, that's the deal. You know, fortunately for those of us who shoot old military calibers and rifles, PPU is out there, and they turn in some of the best stuff going. So for our Serbian friends who work the PPU factory, keep it flowing, brothers. Keep it flowing because it's good stuff. And the other thing I like about it is it performs to at least, and usually it's better, but at least, you know, ball ammunition specifications, and it's not very expensive. So, you know, it's really good stuff. You'll pay more for it than you will surplus, if you can even find surplus in the caliber you want. But you'll pay a little bit more for PPU, but it's not that bad. And it's nice Boxer Prime brass, so if you hand load, you get that going for you too. So that's the deal on the ammo. All right, next question. What is your favorite 22 long rifle rendition of a larger caliber firearm? That's interesting. That's interesting. Well, I can tell you two right offhand. I think that for rifles, hey, the only way to go is the ATI STG 44. It's in 22 long rifle. Because face it, you aren't going to get an STG any other way. I think the originals are selling probably $40,000. So unless you have that kind of cash, the 22 one is the only other ball game out there. And it's really good. It looks the part. The only giveaway is just the, and I wish somebody would come up with a better magazine so you don't need that thumb deal, you know, to bring the follower down. That's the only real giveaway on it. Other than that, it's pretty solid as an imposter. So I would definitely go with the ATI STG 44 in 22 long rifle. And if your range or shooting area allows it, I think they would be great if you got that 22 caliber tracers and you use those. I think that'd be a lot of fun. My range does not permit that. But if you can find a place where you can safely do that, I think that would be very, very cool and a lot of fun. There are some other very cool 22s out there for pistols. I shoot a Colt Ace, not one of the originals, but one of the late 70s ones. And that's a really great gun. But there are other 22 1911 clones out there. I don't know too much about them, but they're all functionally going to be about the same, going to feel the same. So those are going to be really good options to get. And I think there's several different manufacturers of those. The other one that I would go for as a pistol would be the Walther PPK 22. It looks the part. Hey, 22. And it's, you know, small enough to be concealed if you wanted to carry a 22 long rifle as a defensive gun. I think that fits the envelope. I don't know that anybody really advocates that, but definitely it's a nice little gun that you could put in a pocket and just have with you, as opposed to a larger gun that you leave behind. So anyway, I think that's the those are the ones that I would go with. There are all kinds of other ones that range from old service rifle 22 caliber trainers. You can get them Enfields and Mosin Nagants and Mausers, you know, and those are going to cost a lot of money. There's also, you know, occasionally AKs that come out that are 22s. You know, I mean, and of course there's the ARs, there's the Uzis, there's MP5s. None of those really float my boat because they just don't. But the ones I mentioned before do, because there is no other alternative to getting an STG 44 right now other than buying an original, which is beyond the means of, well, certainly everyone I know. So definitely that's the way to work it. So anyway, let's go to the next question. Why don't you like the 9mm? Well, it's not that I don't like 9mm. I have 9mm guns. I actually like 9mm. I don't like it in some of the envelopes in which it is now being stuck. And what I really mean by that is we're now approaching the place where we're having 20-shot 9mm. By the time people get their magazine extensions, you know, the little things that'll put in two or three extra rounds or extended magazines, whatever it is, we're rapidly approaching that point where, you know, we're going to have 20 and 25, maybe even 25 rounders. I've got actually two 20-round magazines for my Beretta, and I kind of finally am really ungangly, you know, but that's just me. So I think when you try to take a full-size, sometimes 9mm does not fit in too large a gun, and I think that's what we're approaching now. The guns are getting larger so they can hold more 9mm. The other thing I don't like is some guns are too small for 9mm, and we chamber them in 9mm because we think that's going to have a power advantage. And I don't know, I suppose that there's some data out there with short barrels and what a 9mm clocks out of a 2 or 3 inch barrel as opposed to a 4 or 5 inch barrel. To me, 9mm is like 38 Special. It's really at its best in kind of medium-sized guns. SIG P226 comes to mind. So does the any of the Walther series, you know, the P38s, all those kind of those mid-size guns. Browning High Power, another one. You know, mid-size gun, it seems to shoot, you get reasonably good power in a reasonably convenient package. And whenever you kind of tip that scale or go to the other ends of the spectrum on that and get the large gun with a lot of capacity, you get something that's awkward and ungangly, or you get something too small, I think you wind up with a gun that's going to have recoil issues because the law of physics has not changed. So that's one of the reasons I'm kind of lukewarm on it. I like it. I shoot it a lot. But I think it has to be kind of, it has to fit into that category where it's in a pistol that's not too big but not too small. So that's my deal with the 9mm. But the premise of the question is I do like 9mm. Frankly, it is becoming 38 Special though. You know, 38 Special was considered a good but kind of an interesting cartridge, you know. And I'd actually think 38 Special is a really interesting cartridge because you can have anything from, you know, law enforcement duty loads to really good target loads. And even the most pedestrian examples of 38 Special firearm, like the, you know, Smith & Wesson Model 10 with a fixed sight, if you put target wad cutters in that, you could shoot very tightly. Now, it didn't have the luxury of adjustable sights, but there were other K-frame revolvers that essentially corrected that, and they shot exceptionally well with the same standard of manufacture that the Model 10 has. So it's really, 38 Special is a very interesting cartridge. 9mm is kind of going there. They're turning out in target quality 9mm. It'll be interesting to see, but it has become the new 38 Special. There's no two ways about that. Okay, the last question of the day, and it's actually obliquely related to guns. And that is, I probably should have covered this earlier, but do you really care who wins the Democratic nomination for president? Well, the answer is I really don't, because it's all the same deal. I'm pretty much a one-issue voter. I figure if I vote gun rights, then everything else kind of falls into place, because it is what it is. So I don't see any Democrat that's worse or better than another. They're all bad. They're all very, very bad. And there's really only two left. My observation is that if you're Bernie Sanders doesn't want it bad enough if he doesn't start fighting for it. And I mean by fighting for it, he needs to go after the fact that Biden is a crazy old man. Hey, Bernie, here's your free campaign advice. Go after Biden because he's a crazy old man. Go after Biden because of his influence peddling, i.e. Burisma and all the rest of this stuff. Go after Biden because he is an establishment clown that they're setting up just so that they can keep control, that he is the establishment guy. If he doesn't go after him super hard on that, that shows me he doesn't want the nomination. He doesn't want it, and he's just too wimpy to take it. I have to tell you, within my own family, my sister-in-law, her Her father, back in the 1990s, was a California state legislator in the legislature. And, you know, the worst bruising fights and the worst enemies he had were in the primary election, not the general election. So, you know, the people in your own party are your biggest enemies. You know, we think it's Republican versus Democrat. But in this case, it's Democrat versus Democrat until there are no Democrats except one left. And that is where you get a lot of dirty politics, a lot of dirty tricks. It isn't like the, you know, and that's just the way the system works. That's the way the system works. And if Bernie doesn't get tough, if Sanders does not get tough and start going after him, there is going to be nothing left. He's going to wind up with not enough delegates to win, and Biden's just going to walk right through it. And that's what it's going to be. You know, it's if you don't fight hard, and you know what? Trump is the case study in that. When he first announced, a lot of people, including myself, thought, oh, this is a publicity stunt. Once I started listening to him, though, I said, hey, you know, this guy's got some ideas, and he may not be the best messenger or the guy with the smoothest style, but he is a guy you can listen to, and he does have some ideas. And I started taking him seriously. I said, this guy could wind up being the nominee, no problem. A lot of other people didn't think so. And then they got angry because, hey, when John McCain calls Trump a joke and a clown, Trump goes after his war record. It's like, hey, guess what? All is fair. All is fair in politics, man. And I know that there are some people who are still butthurt over that, but you know what? That's just the way it goes. And politics is a tough game, and you got to be a tough operator. And, you know, Bernie is showing his true colors. He doesn't want it enough. He's not tough enough. And he's not going to get it unless he starts fighting hard, fighting dirty, and fighting every way he can. He's not going to get it. Right now, he should be going on every network news program that will have him, every radio show that will have him, and he should be after Biden. Don't even worry about Trump. Go after Biden, because that's the guy you have to beat right now. So that's my free political advice for Bernie Sanders. And of course, he won't take it or do it. He's going to go down like the whimpering, whining scoundrel that he is. And he's just going to go down that way. And that's the breaks, man. That's the breaks. You don't fight, you don't win. You know, you don't see guys being nice inside. Remember what we were talking about earlier, the octagon? You know, you don't see those MMA fighters being nice inside the ring. Bernie's got to be the same thing. Go for anything. Anything. Anyway, this is another edition of Old School Guns that is complete. You can always do the comments, like I said earlier, on Podbean or kbmakel@aol.com. We'd love to hear from you. Love getting those questions. So, anyway, this is Old School Guns out.